The most influential teacher there, and Roginsky's mentor, was the cultural historian Yuri Lotman. While it was impossible to conduct courses and draw up reading lists on subjects considered anti-Soviet, Lotman and his students looked at the structure of literary texts and cultures in a way that they all understood as a thinly veiled critique of the society they were living in. Their refusal to use newspeak and channel everything into Marxist-Leninist categories was a form of dissidence. At Tartu, Roginsky's classmates included Natalia Gorbanevskaya, who joined Pavel Litvinov on Red Square for the 1968 demonstration, and Nikita Okhotin, another future leader of Memorial. After graduating and moving to Leningrad, Roginsky took a tremendous risk. He founded an underground group called Pamyat, or Memory, not to be confused with the racist Russian nationalist group of the same name. Roginsky's Pamyat was a forerunner to Memorial. Working secretly and with friends in the dissident movement, he began building an archive of Western and Soviet documents on the Stalin period. Roginsky followed Solzhenitsyn's lead in the Gulag Archipelago and interviewed dozens of camp survivors about their experiences. "More than anything, I wanted to prove that the study of history actually could exist in this country," he told me. It was not long before the police and the KGB were onto him. They searched his apartment 7 times, bugged his telephone, and called him in for questioning. But while the KGB obviously knew what Roginsky was up to, he made it difficult for them, carefully burying his tapes and papers. The KGB never found that evidence. Then, in 1981, the KGB ended all pretense toward the legal niceties. They arrested Roginsky, and he was sentenced to 4 years in the camps. They moved him from camp to camp in order to prevent him from infecting the other inmates with anti-Soviet ideas, and to make sure he never got too comfortable. When Roginsky finally returned to Moscow in August 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev was in power. He was ready to try the same crime again. "I had to assume that history would outlast stupidity and cruelty," he said. Through the spring of 1988, Memorial was adding thousands of names to its petition lists. Gorbachev planned on holding a special conference at the end of June to plant the seeds of a more democratic political system. And Memorial wanted to find some way to use the historic meeting to establish itself. For that, it needed support at a higher level. It needed backing from people who would command the attention of at least the reformist flank in the party leadership. The activists needed a core of names that would lend some political heft to Memorial. Most of the names were obvious. Sakharov, of course. Writers such as Alice Adamovich, Dmitry Likachev, Daniel Granin, Lev Razgon, Anatoly Rybakov, and Yuri Karyakin. The editor of Ogonyok, Vitaly Korotich, and Boris Yeltsin, who had become a mythic figure of defiance after his ouster from the Politburo in 1987. And there were two historians on the list. The first was Roy Alexandrovich Medvedev. Throughout the Khrushchev and Brezhnev eras, there had been other scholars who tried to work honestly, to conduct research outside the system of party rules and guarded archives. Mikhail Gefter, another of Arseny Roginsky's mentors, was well known to historians in the West for his essays on what he saw as the Stalinist aberration. Viktor Danilov's groundbreaking first attempts to describe the scope and brutality of the collectivization campaign had also won respect abroad. But while Western historians, trying to piece together the scale of the Soviet catastrophe, relied almost solely on published Soviet documents, literature, and émigré sources, Only one historian still living in Moscow played a major role in deepening the world's understanding of Stalin and his successors. The publication in the West of Medvedev's Let History Judge in 1971 astonished foreign scholars with its unstinting denunciation of Stalin and the sheer accumulation of evidence. I came to Moscow thinking that Roy Medvedev was the man to know. Dozens of my predecessors, especially the American and Italian correspondents, depended mightily on him for analysis and high-grade gossip. Who was fighting whom? Who had a fatal cold in the Politburo? The same sources in the world of Communist Party politics, bureaucracy, and journalism, who had informed Let History Judge, also provided Medvedev with nuggets of information that, for foreigners, could be mined almost nowhere else. Roy and his wife, Galina, lived on Dybenko Street, in a distant part of town not far from Sheremetyevo Airport. Medvedev's tiny study was a meticulous arrangement of books and files, a masterly use of space imposed by necessity. File cards peeked out of the shelves announcing early Leninists, Beria, or Brezhnev. Roy's twin brother, Joris, who had lived in a middle-class section of London called Mill Hill since his exile in 1973, had arranged his own office in the same fashion. London street life murmured outside, but inside, Joris had recreated Russia. All through their separation, Roy and Joris exchanged necessities with the help of obliging Western diplomats and journalists. For Joris's books on Soviet agriculture and the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, Roy sent clippings and source materials. Joris handled Roy's foreign language publication rights and sent him packages of books, rubber bands, envelopes, folders, and underwear, socks, and shoes. Before Gorbachev came to power, Roy Medvedev was considered a dissident. After years of study and teaching school in the provinces, Medvedev took Khrushchev's secret speech in 1956 at the 20th Party Congress and the further anti-Stalinist mood of the 22nd Party Congress in 1961 as a signal of permission. Year after year, he accumulated source materials and interviews with party officials, camp survivors, and other witnesses to the era. As a scholar, he pushed the limits of the possible. But Medvedev's timing was dangerous. By the time he finished Let History Judge and sent it to the West for publication, Khrushchev was out of office and Brezhnev had already begun a movement to rehabilitate the reputation of Stalin. Medvedev, who had maintained his membership in the Communist Party, was soon banned from its ranks. But while he was rejected by officialdom, he was also never really accepted by the dissidents. In his memoirs, Sakharov rarely levels any personal attacks, but in several spots he makes it clear that by the early 70s, he not only disagreed with Medvedev's Marxism, but also did not entirely trust him. Without saying so directly, he wonders if Medvedev did not have at least the tacit support of, or some kind of unsavory relationship with, the KGB. Other dissidents were far less guarded in their conjectures. I find it hard to believe the worst. In the early 80s, a KGB guard sat outside Medvedev's door, and I doubt he was there to give out flowers to foreign guests. The specter scared off some visitors, but not all. And by the time I arrived, Roy still gave help to anyone who asked for it. I think his fallen reputation among the dissidents, and then later among the liberal intelligentsia as a whole, had more to do with his refusal to shed Marxism than with any shady dealings with the party and its organs. It seemed strange to me that people who had never made a peep for 30 years could forgive themselves rather quickly for their cowardice, but were brutally critical of Medvedev's constancy. This was a man who first made sense of his life as a scholar during an interrogation at Lefortovo prison in the mid-70s. "Comrade Medvedev, tell me, please," the KGB officer had said. "Would you have written your books about Stalin if your father hadn't been sent away to the camps?" For nearly two decades before the start of Glasnost, the KGB had regularly shown its interest in Roy and Joris Medvedev. Joris was Roy's equivalent in the scientific world, a biologist and gerontologist who wrote about the abuse of genetics under Stalin and the use of psychiatric wards as prisons for dissidents under Brezhnev. In 1970, the authorities declared that Joris suffered from paranoid delusions of reforming society and threw him into an insane asylum. Only Roy's intervention, his rallying of Soviet and Western scholars, forced the Kremlin to release Joris within 3 weeks. The KGB officer at Lefortovo had surely asked Roy the right question. Why? No one had ever posed it to him quite so directly or with such perverse intent. I realized then just how closely my destiny was intertwined with my father's, Roy told me one day in his tiny study. I was sitting there in that prison room, and it all came back. On an August night in 1938, there was a knock on the door. The familiar scene had begun. Working with their uncanny efficiency and speed, KGB men introduced themselves and went to work. The twins, fair and thin, sat up in bed and tried to make out the muffled commotion outside the bedroom door. "Why do you come so late, comrades?" they heard their father say. They could not make out the answer. For weeks, the boys had noticed that their father was depressed, eating almost nothing. It was a mystery to them why their father, Alexander Medvedev, a respected officer in the Red Army and a professor of philosophy and history at the Tolmachev Military Political Academy, had been fired from his job. And why had they been sent home early that summer from Pioneer Camp? Some of the family's friends had been arrested, but the boys could not understand what their father understood only too well, that the defining principle of the terror was its randomness. There was no reason for any of this except the ruthlessness, perhaps the pathology, of Joseph Stalin and the system he had built. When the boys woke the next morning, the visitors were still there, opening and slamming cabinets, pushing aside furniture, rummaging through everything. The bedroom door opened and the boy's father walked in. He was dressed in a military tunic, but wore no belt. He looked as if he'd gone days with no sleep. Without a word, he sat down on the bed and embraced his sons. There was something final and desperate about his grip. Joris told me he still remembered the feel of his father's prickly, unshaven face scratching against his cheek. How his father's wordless terror was so obvious, so physical, that all three began to cry at once. A few minutes later, the visitors left with Alexander Medvedev. In the first months after the arrest of their father, Roy and Joris and their mother received a series of letters from Alexander Medvedev. He was writing from Kolyma, the camps of the Far East. Some of the letters from their father were addressed for forwarding to the Communist Party Central Committee, the Supreme Court, the secret police. They all protested his innocence. There was always the sense that this was odd, a mistake that could not have happened to us, Joris said. Of course, everyone in the country, when it touched them, felt that way. Roy and Joris had idolized their father. He had been a strict teacher and a scholarly example to them, urging them to read everything from Jack London to the Russian classics. His letters to them from Kolyma betrayed none of his own suffering. They concentrated instead on the boy's future. My dear Roy and Rez, at last spring has come, a rare guest in this part of the country. I am very far from you, but in my thoughts and in my heart I am very close, closer than ever. You fill my everyday thoughts, and you are the aim and essence of my life. You are on the threshold of becoming young men. I so want to be beside you and give you all my experience and deliver you from youth's mistakes. But destiny has decided otherwise. I do not want my absence from your lives to sadden your youth. The main thing is that you must study persistently and not limit yourselves just to the school program. Use your time when your perceptiveness and memory are especially keen. Try to be disciplined in your work, for even a mediocre man can accomplish a great deal if he is disciplined. You are talented, capable boys. You must learn to think and be well organized. What you need above all is patience. You must learn to overcome difficulties no matter how large. I am sorry for the preaching tone. Love, your father. In the winter of 1941, the Medvedev family received a letter from Alexander saying he was in the hospital and needed vitamins. A few months later, a letter they had sent to him in Kolyma came back unopened and stamped, "The money is returned on account of the death of the addressee." For a while, the family could not accept this all-too-obvious reality and continued sending parcels. But each time they were returned with the same dark stamp. When he was just a teenager, Roy's mother told him, "Don't be a philosopher or a historian. It's too dangerous and too painful." When Roy was studying at Leningrad State University in the 40s, he began to do some independent research. He slowly uncovered who had betrayed his father. At the height of the terror, Boris Chagin was both a military officer and an intelligence agent of the NKVD, the precursor to the KGB. He was the author of numerous letters slandering his fellow officers. Those letters helped send many men, including Alexander Medvedev, to the camps. In Leningrad, Roy discovered that Chagin held a prestigious position in the same history department in which Roy was studying. Chagin was a professor of dialectical materialism. The Medvedev brothers stood off to the side, observing the man who had betrayed their father. Jaurès especially made a thorough study of Chagin's books, The Struggle of Marxism-Leninism Against the Philosophy of Revisionism, and The Struggle of Marxism-Leninism Against Reactionary Philosophy. They took no action. They did not confront him. They learned. "I felt disdain for him, but not hatred or the desire for revenge," Jaurès said. Decades later, when Roy was interviewing camp survivors for Let History Judge, a woman called him at home. "Are you the son of Alexander Medvedev?" she asked. Roy said he was, and the woman invited him to visit her at her apartment, which she shared with several other survivors from the Kolyma camps. There, for the first time, Medvedev heard the story of his father's death, how he had injured his arm in an accident while working in a copper mine and was sent to work in a greenhouse. He developed cancer and was admitted to the camp infirmary. The inmates knew their friend was gone only when they saw the camp foreman walking like a peacock around the muddy yard. He was wearing the dark wool jacket Alexander Medvedev had had on his back when he arrived in Kolyma. For all his credentials as a scholar, Roy Medvedev was not for Memorial, and Memorial was not for him. Although he was nominally a member of the group's public committee, its council of well-known senior figures, Medvedev did not attend meetings and even doubted the value of the group. Roy believed in Gorbachev and in the party as the only legitimate body of power. Memorial to him seemed ragtag, beside the point. The man who quickly took the lead as Memorial's chief scholar-politician and was an admitted hypocrite, a calculating man who had been on the editorial board of Communist and was an instructor in the higher school of the Young Communist League. Yuri Afanasyev had no illusions about his past. "For more years than I care to remember," he said one night on television, "I was up to my neck in shit." His ascendance was astonishing. In my first year in Moscow, Afanasyev was already the Democratic Movement's master of ceremonies. At nearly every meeting you'd go to, at the Saturday morning sessions of Moscow Tribune, at the lectures on Stalin, Afanasyev was invariably the man at the microphone, mediating, introducing, lecturing. He was a specialist in French historiography, and yet he looked, with his bullfrog neck and barrel chest, like a high school football coach. He had the gruff confidence of a man who had led many a committee meeting, first in the Young Communist League, the Komsomol, later in the Radical Opposition. His metamorphosis was not so much laughable as pitiable. Here was a man who never would have dared defend Roy Medvedev in the 70s, and then scorned him as hopelessly reactionary in the late 80s. But I found that, for all his presumption, his gall, Afanasyev's analyses of what was happening in the country and where the situation was leading were uncanny. There were times when Afanasyev, with his supreme confidence, reminded me of Norman Mailer. He knew he had lived a life full of mistakes, but he insisted on being heard. His campaign for the return of history, his early attacks on the Stalinist Brezhnevite Supreme Soviet and on Gorbachev himself, always preceded fashion. He was not much loved. He had none of Sakharov's subtlety or carriage. But he was often right. In contrast, Medvedev's predictions now were not nearly as reliable as his gossip had once been. Typically, the day that Eduard Shevardnadze resigned as foreign minister in December 1990, predicting the rise of a dictatorship, Medvedev declared to all who would listen that Shevardnadze was stepping down because of trouble in the Georgian Republic. Afanasyev grew up in Ulyanovsk, the town where Lenin was born. His father, a household repairman, was sent to jail for several years in eastern Siberia on the usual false pretense. He had pilfered a few kilos of flour from the collective farm to give to a poor family. But the strange thing Afanasyev told me one afternoon at his office at the Historical Archives Institute is that we did not experience it as a grief or tragedy, because literally every other person we knew then was in prison for collecting leftovers on the farm or for missing a day of work. We never had any conversations about Stalin, and I had no doubts about him. Like Gorbachev, Afanasyev was a provincial boy whose grades were good enough to gain him admission to the best university in the country, Moscow State University. As a student, Afanasyev said, I was like everyone else. I memorized the short course like any good Komsomol boy, like any other communist. On the night before Stalin's funeral in March 1953, Afanasyev wandered the streets near the Kremlin. Tens of thousands of people jammed the streets headed for the Hall of Columns, where Stalin lay in his coffin. People were hysterical, racked with fear after the death of their living god. Dozens, perhaps hundreds of people suffocated to death in the mad crush to get to the hall. Afanasyev broke free of the crowd. As he walked, he could hear some drunks singing in an alleyway. He had never heard such joyous singing. The drunks were celebrating the death of Stalin. I suppose once or twice in a lifetime you have those moments when you see something or hear something that tilts your life just slightly in another direction. When I heard those men, well, suddenly the purity of my political consciousness was stained, Afanasyev said. I felt the first moment of doubt. It wasn't until Khrushchev's speech 3 years later that I really started to rethink things more thoroughly. But it was this drunken celebration in the dark corners of Moscow that made me start to doubt. I was never quite the same. After graduation, Afanasyev worked as a Komsomol leader in Krasnoyarsk, not far from where his father had been in jail. He certainly was no radical. He believed in the infinite possibilities of the party. He and his friends talked about the great vistas of Leninist ideology, the great hydroelectric power station they, or at least the workers, were building. That enthusiasm, he said, lasted until the late 60s, when Brezhnev tried to reanimate Stalinism. Back in Moscow, Afanasyev worked in the national leadership of the Komsomol organization, and then took his graduate degree in history, specializing in French historiography. Afanasyev knew enough to stay away from Soviet history as a field. That's where all the real idiots and time servers were. But even in his own work, he made sure to glorify the obvious and denigrate foreign influence. For years, his published works set out to prove that the bourgeois historians had grossly misinterpreted the October Revolution. Basically, he said, I scoured the texts for their glaring insufficiencies. But, like so many others of his generation, Afanasyev developed a kind of two-track mind. Because he was such a loyal servant of the official line, he was sent abroad several times to study in France. In Paris, Afanasyev read books by the dissidents and émigrés. He lived in an academic atmosphere where he could speak a little more freely. So, by the time he returned to Moscow, Afanasyev had changed just a little more. Once more he had heard the shouting from the dark corners, and he responded. Or at least, part of him did. Little by little it became harder for him to resist the evidence. His faith, what little there was of it, eroded. Polish students at the university told him about Stalin's massacres of Polish officers in the Katyn Forest. Afanasyev saw how senior professors of history at the university were arrested, or at least fired and silenced, when they strayed too far from doctrine. In the late 70s and early 80s, Afanasyev was a resident scholar of the Critique of Bourgeois Historiography at a Moscow institute, and was an editor at Communiste, the party's chief theoretical journal. When Gorbachev came to office, Afanasyev wrote him a series of daring letters about the situation in Soviet historical science, calling on him to use his position as general secretary to end restrictions on academic study and open the archives of the party and the KGB. Afanasyev got no direct answers. But he did win the key appointment in 1986 to take over as rector of the Historical Archives Institute, and quickly used that position to give the first public lectures criticizing Stalin and introducing to the public several new faces, Dima Yorosov included. Afanasyev was determined to use his new post to help open up the study of the Soviet past. Exploiting his new access to at least some party archives, he reviewed the letters of Olga Shatunovskaya, a woman who had been a member of the Communist Party Control Committee under Khrushchev. In those letters, Shatunovskaya wrote that she had collected 64 folders of documents saying that, according to KGB and party data, between January 1935 and 1941, 19,800,000 people had been arrested, and of these, 7 million were executed in prisons. Her statement was supported by specific data describing how many were shot and where and when. But the files Shatunovskaya described were declared missing. By reading such letters, Afanasyev began to realize that the party and the KGB had probably destroyed many of the most incriminating documents in the archives. Afanasyev got into some of his first battles with the party hierarchy when he began to insist that professional scholars and not the Central Committee, not even the General Secretary, should be the country's principal historians. Although Gorbachev's 1987 history speech helped open the process, Afanasyev said that there could no longer be such speeches. As long as such things still exist, he said, there will still be the idea that history should be made not in the archives and universities and by writers, but rather at party conferences and committees. That way, history remains a handmaiden of propaganda and an extension of policy, rather than a sphere of knowledge on the level of science or literature. If power wants to gain authority, then it has to say honestly, we are not linked in any way with the previous regime. When we talk about perestroika, we see it in the following way. The former model of socialism was no good, so let's work out a new model and put it into life. Again, we have it backward. We must give up this idea of a conscious construction of a more perfect society. The whole culture of belief in the limitless capabilities and opportunities of the human mind, and the ability to construct a model of socially engineered society, and then realize it all. Educators and utopian thinkers used to think that the opportunities were endless, that the idea of a just society could be formed by the human mind, that it could be discovered on a theoretical basis. And it seemed to them that those theories could be realized in practice. In other words, a society of universal justice and prosperity could be built by thinking things out. We are now living through the final stages of that culture. Marx and Lenin are vanishing. They are being swept away in the same way that the truth of Newtonian mechanics was swept away by Einstein and relativity. By June 1988, Gorbachev's victory in the Nina Andreeva affair had given the Memorial leadership a sense of hope and expectation. Afanasyev and the liberal head of the Filmmakers' Union, L.M. Klimov, decided to seize on the 19th Party Conference as Memorial's moment. Both men had been elected delegates to the conference, and here was a chance to propose the Memorial platform to the top officials of the Communist Party. Afanasyev had already helped to lay the political and intellectual groundwork for Memorial's plan. A few weeks before the conference, he produced the most important political book of the Gorbachev era, Inogo ne Dano, There is No Other Way, a collection of 35 essays by the leading intellectuals of the Thaw generation, men and women who had become the torchbearers of the Glasnost era. While Gorbachev's own book, Perestroika, was sodden with party cliché, There Is No Other Way provided dazzling clarity and a sense of possibility. Published by the huge state-run firm Progress and edited by Afanasyev, There Is No Other Way read like an underground manifesto, but it was printed officially and on good paper. Afanasyev, Mikhail Gefter, the Renaissance scholar Leonid Batkin, and the journalist Len Karpinsky all wrote essays on the persistence of Stalinism and the need to evaluate the past in order to create a humane future. In one way or another, the need for truth, for a clear-eyed view of history, was behind every piece in the collection. Among them, Vasily Selyunin's analysis of the Soviet bureaucracy, Alexei Yablokov's survey of ecological disasters, Yuri Chernichenko's essay on the agro-gulag of the collective farm system, Gavril Popov's piece on the absurdity of the centralized economic system. Nearly all the authors were scholars and journalists who had for years pulled their punches, spoken in euphemism, or spoken not at all. The presence of one author, however, honored the entire project. The simple addition of Andrei Sakharov and his essay, The Necessity of Perestroika, showed that an alliance existed between the dissidents and a much wider category, the liberal intelligentsia. Sakharov's article was not much different from his underground manifestos. What was different now was the audience. The first printing alone was 100,000. Until Sakharov's release from exile, there were probably not 10,000 people in the country who knew the name Sakharov as anything other than an odious figure in the pages of Pravda and Izvestia. In his essay, Sakharov wrote that perestroika was like a war. Victory is a necessity. To even begin to win that war, he wrote, the leadership had to end the folly in Afghanistan, sponsor a thorough rewriting of the criminal code, endorse freedom of speech, and agree to a radical reduction in strategic and conventional weapons. In the next 2 years, Gorbachev would follow Sakharov's prescriptions almost to the letter. A few days after buying my blue and silver copy of There Is No Other Way, I went to a demonstration organized by Memorial outside a sports arena in Moscow. It was a brilliant sunny day, and the people on the streets outside the arena took obvious delight in their freedom to chant slogans and carry signs reading, No to political repression, Death to Stalinism, Stalin's boot still endangers us. A half dozen of the contributors to There Is No Other Way gave speeches on the steps. But one moment struck me above all. Not far from Sakharov, a young man carried a sign saying in Russian, I would like to call you all by name, the famous line from Anna Akhmatova's long poem Requiem. During Stalin's terror, Akhmatova spent 17 months, day after day, waiting in long lines to find out what had become of her son, who had been arrested at the height of the purges. One day someone identified me, she wrote in a preface to the poem. Beside me, in the queue, there was a woman with blue lips. She had, of course, never heard of me. But she suddenly came out of that trance so common to us all, and whispered in my ear, everyone spoke in whispers there, Can you describe this? And I said, Yes, I can. And then something like the shadow of a smile crossed what had once been her face. I quote a few lines here, in a translation by D. M. Thomas, because in them Memorial found its voice and credo. Again the hands of the clock are nearing the unforgettable hour. I see, hear, touch all of you. The cripple they had to support painfully to the end of the line, the moribund, and the girl who would shake her beautiful head and say, I come here as if it were home. I should like to call you all by name, but they have lost the lists. I have woven for them a great shroud out of the poor words I overheard them speak. I remember them always and everywhere. And if they shut my tormented mouth, through which 100 million of my people cry, let them remember me also. And if ever in this country they should want to build me a monument, I consent to that honor, but only on the condition that they erect it not on the seashore where I was born. My last links there were broken long ago. Nor by the stump in the royal gardens, where an inconsolable young shade is seeking me. But here, where I stood for 300 hours, and where they never, never opened the doors for me. Lest in blessed death I should forget the grinding scream of the Black Marias, the hideous clanging gate, the old woman wailing like a wounded beast. And may the melting snow drop like tears from my motionless bronze eyelids, and the prison pigeons coo above me, and the ships sail slowly down the Neva. A few days after the demonstration, Afanasyev and Klimov hauled their huge sacks of petitions through the gates of the Kremlin. It was the opening day of the 19th Party Conference, and the party apparatchiks eyed them suspiciously. Afanasyev and Klimov presented the petitions to Gorbachev and his aides and waited for a response. On the last day of the 19th Party Conference, after Boris Yeltsin's dramatic appeal for rehabilitation, After a war over the direction of reform, Gorbachev took the podium and delivered a long speech. Just before he finished, he said that an idea had been introduced, one that echoed a similar suggestion in 1961 by Khrushchev, to build a memorial to the victims of the Stalin era. Now the party, he said, must finally approve the idea. Gorbachev's words had a tacked-on feel to them. They sounded like an afterthought. In fact, it was one of the most critical moments in the political and emotional life of the Perestroika era. Although the party would later try to block Memorial, although it would try to deny it funds and meeting places, the group had sown the first seeds of a struggle far deeper and more unpredictable than anyone had imagined. Chapter 9. Written on the Water. Just as Memorial's demonstration outside the sports arena was ending, Arnold Yeryomenko's plane was landing. Yeryomenko lived in Magadan, the city that had once been the capital of the Kolyma region of the Gulag Archipelago in the Soviet Far East. The rest of the passengers were worn out from the 10-hour flight to Moscow aboard Aeroflot's cramped and creaky liner. The one meal served had been a Dixie cup of green mineral water and a greasy chicken wing. Somehow, Arnold bounded off the plane, refreshed, he said. He'd come to Moscow on a mission. Yeryomenko was the leader of the Democratic Initiative, the first non-communist political group ever in Magadan. The group's membership decided to send him as a delegate to the 19th Party Conference. "We figured that if democracy is starting in this country, then we ought to be heard too," he said. The membership passed a hat and collected his 800-ruble round-trip airfare. Before he left, Arnold called me in Moscow. He said he had heard my articles read in Russian on Radio Liberty. Could we meet? Of course. Not only had Yeryomenko managed to sound engaging at a distance of 6,000 miles, I was also eager to talk to someone from Magadan. Magadan had always defined distant to me, an almost mythical outpost, closer to Los Angeles than Moscow, where the winters are 10 months long and a mild day in January is 40 degrees below zero. Magadan is the setting for two of the best books ever written about Stalinism: Yevgenia Ginsberg's memoirs Journey into the Whirlwind, and her son Vasily Aksionov's novel The Burn. Magadan was, in a sense, the freest town in Russia, Aksionov wrote. In it there lived the special deportees and the special contingent, which included those categorized SHE, socially harmful elements, and SDE, socially dangerous elements. Nationalists, social democrats, Catholics, Muslims, Buddhists. People who recognized themselves as the lowest slaves, and who therefore had challenged fate. In June 1988, Magadan was still closed to foreigners. The only way to get there was on an official Potemkin village tour with the foreign ministry. It was on such a trip in the summer of 1944 that Vice President Henry Wallace decided that Kolyma was wonderful, and the regional secret police chief, the infamous General Goglidze, was a very fine man, very efficient, gentle and understanding with people. I met Arnold at the Lenin statue on October Square near my building. He was in his early 50s with the silver hair and fine features of Cesar Romero, quick and jaunty as a bantamweight. "You are Remnick," he said. "Well, come, I've got great things to show you." Arnold spoke such good English that when we switched to Russian, I had the odd sensation that he had an American accent. Probably he was just dumbing down his Russian for my sorry self. He told me he had learned his English in school, but mostly from listening to the foreign voices, Radio Liberty, the voice of America, and especially the BBC. Evidently, the jamming system had been less efficient in Magadan than in Moscow. On the short walk to my apartment, Arnold told me he was born in 1937, the year the purges really began. His father was an engineer who had been assigned to Magadan for his technical expertise. In those days, Magadan was still short on barracks and ports for the slave ships that came in every few days from Vladivostok. It was kind of a gulag boomtown, Arnold said with a terrific smile. It was the gateway to hell. Even in late spring, the ice was thick near the shore. It was on days like those that the tramp steamers could not make it through to the docks. The prisoners, many of them barefoot and dressed in rags, had to walk on the ice for the last mile to shore. A camp orchestra would assemble on the ice and play for the new prisoners, usually a march or a waltz. In a way, arrival was a relief. The journey had been such hell. The train trip to the Far East from Moscow and European Russia was in cattle cars, and it took a month at least. The prisoners were packed together so tightly that it was said there were those who starved to death and were found still upright at the end of the journey. At the embarkation points on the Pacific, inspectors went up and down the line looking for slaves. Like horsemen before an auction, inspectors checked the prisoners' teeth and eyes. They pinched their biceps and buttocks to see how much muscle tone there was left after more than a month in the cattle cars. At Vanino in the late 1940s, the NKVD had a contract to supply some state firms for 120,000 slave workers a year. The rest of the prisoners were then packed into the holds of tramp steamers headed for Magadan. As the purges became a permanent condition of state in the 30s and 40s, rumors of the sea journey reached Moscow and the other big cities on the mainland. But no rumor could capture the horror of the voyage itself. Michael Solomon, a Romanian prisoner, wrote of his shock as he was herded into the hold of the ship Sovlatvia, headed north to Magadan. It was a scene, he said, which neither Goya nor Gustave Doré could ever have imagined. Thousands of men and women, dressed in rags, half dead and covered with boils and blisters. At the bottom of the stairway we had just climbed down stood a giant cask, on the edges of which, in full view of the soldiers standing on guard above, women were perched like birds, and in the most incredible positions. There was no shame, no prudery, as they crouched there to urinate or empty their bowels. One had the impression that they were some half-human, half-bird creatures, which belonged to a different world and a different age. Yet, seeing a man come down the stairs, although a mere prisoner like themselves, many of them began to smile, and some even tried to comb their hair. Later, the officers would load on board even more prisoners. Not more politicals, but murderers, thieves, rapists, whores. When I saw this half-naked, tattooed, ape-like horde invade the hold, Evgenia Ginsberg wrote, I thought that it had been decided that we were to be killed off by madwomen. The fetid air reverberated to their shrieks, their ferocious obscenities, their wild laughter and their caterwaulings. They capered about incessantly, stamping their feet, even though there appeared to be no room to put a foot down. Without wasting any time, they set about terrorizing and bullying the ladies, the politicals, delighted to find that the enemies of the people were creatures even more despised and outcast than themselves. Within 5 minutes we had a thorough introduction to the law of the jungle. Feeding time came, and the warders dumped a cartload of bread down the hold and into the gaping mouths of the beasts. The killing went on and on, day after day, and in every form. The ships would often get caught in the ice far from any shore, and the crew had no choice but to wait out the weather and keep the rations for themselves. The wait could go on for weeks, even months. Thousands of prisoners would die of hunger and disease. Sometimes the guards left the corpses in the hold with the living. Sometimes they pitched the dead over the rails onto the ice, where they stayed day after day, rotting, until the thaw came and the sea swallowed them and the ship sailed on to Magadan. That was the world Arnold Yeryomenko grew up in, the landscape of his childhood and youth. The ships would come in to shore all the time, he said, as we sat down to some coffee in my kitchen. I remember seeing the prisoners in huge lines, 5,000-6,000 men and women in rags, exhausted, being marched from the ships and onto the shore and up to the barracks. The guards were always beating them in the street, and sometimes you heard the pistols going off. Sometimes you'd see a dead man in the street. Maybe no one had time to cart him off. Arnold's professional life never really got going. He studied engineering and foreign languages in the early 1960s. But he was broke, and to make some extra money, he tried to trade on the black market. He was arrested and put in jail for 10 years. When he was freed, he was not allowed to live in Moscow, and he moved back home to Magadan. The humiliation of his arrest and imprisonment, and his growing sense that the cruelty he had seen as a child was still an essential part of the social order of the Soviet Union, helped make Yeryomenko an angry man, a political man. In 1981 he wrote a book condemning the Communist Party and circulated it in samizdat editions. For that he got 2 more years in prison. When perestroika finally started in Moscow, Arnold was impudent enough to think that reform ought to come to Magadan as well. He started Democratic Initiative. He stood outside KGB headquarters, he and a few kids and housewives, shouting slogans into a bullhorn. He was summarily fired from his construction job. The local party committee and the KGB began to treat this out-of-work engineer and his younger friends in Democratic Initiative like an invading army. They bugged, harassed, and occasionally jailed the members on false charges. Arnold said I should come see for myself. I told him I'd always wanted to go to Magadan, but it was still a closed city. "Well, you don't have to go," he said. "I can show it to you on television." He took a video cassette out of his briefcase and said, "Do you have Beta or VHS?" He explained that one of the members of Democratic Initiative had bought a video camera on a trip to Alaska. "It's better than having a newspaper, which of course we can't," he said. The tape flickered and jerked, and then finally found its focus on a crowd of about 2,500 people on the city's main square. Lenin Square, of course. There were signs protesting that the city's leading Communist Party officials had grabbed up all the delegate seats to the party conference in Moscow. There was Arnold shouting into a bullhorn, demanding that the party, the sole possessor of power in this country, let representatives from outside the party apparatus represent Magadan in Moscow. Another speaker pointed to the White House, the relatively elegant-looking building that was the party headquarters, and asked why the communists always hogged all the wealth. "That's where the mafia lives," the speaker shouted. "That's why they have to be guarded day and night by the militia. They're criminals." Another speaker demanded that a special hotel for visiting party officials be converted into a kindergarten. It wasn't easy to make out all they said. The police had hooked up a set of speakers near the demonstration and played deafening Soviet pop music to drown out democracy. The most dramatic moment came when Ludmila Romanova, a local party official, accepted Arnold's invitation to address the crowd. The young woman spoke with a kind of hyped-up spirit, but she could only talk in the old party way. She told the anti-party demonstrators that they had assembled without proper permission from the party. but she did say that workers would be invited to participate in discussions about new schools and other civic improvements. "We're sick of your promises. We don't want your words," came some of the more polite replies. Then Romanova ended with a prim reminder of Soviet legality. "You must know," she said, "that according to the Constitution, the political rights given to the people should not damage the rights of others." The crowd was less than impressed with her insinuation and booed her off the platform. Now Arnold was laughing. He got up from his chair and pointed to a building and a set of windows in the top right-hand corner of the screen. "There," he said, "look at that building. You can see the KGB guys in the windows taking our picture." The next day, Arnold tried to deliver Democratic Initiative's manifesto and petitions to the party conference. We stood about half a mile from the Kremlin and watched one black limousine after another ferry the visiting party hacks to the conference. "They won't let me near the place," Arnold said. After he dumped off his documents at a party reception hall, he booked a seat back to Magadan. Back at my place, we watched some of the conference on television. We were like football fanatics on New Year's Day. We could not take our eyes off the set. Arnold hissed the hacks and cheered on the liberals. "You know what will bring these people down," he said. "Embarrassment. One day they will just slink off the stage." Like most of the liberals in Moscow, Arnold was all for Gorbachev's scheme to create a new legislature, but suspicious that it would be rigged and loaded with party leaders. He loved watching Yeltsin's confrontation with Yegor Ligachev, his plea to the party for rehabilitation, and his call for a faster, more radical program of democratization. Looking dazed by the task ahead, Yeltsin jutted his jaw and barged on, evoking in speech, if not in manner, nothing less than the return of Nikolai Bukharin and other old Bolsheviks who had been shot in the purges and restored to the party ranks under Gorbachev. "Comrade delegates, rehabilitation 50 years after a person's death has now become the rule, and this has a healthy effect on society. But I am asking for political rehabilitation while I am still alive." Yeltsin also lambasted Ligachev for trying to railroad him and obstruct reform in general. Ligachev had his chance at the podium and replied, "Boris, you are wrong." To Yeltsin's barrel-chested, hangdog heavyweight, Ligachev came across on television as a street-tough middleweight. He was furious, accusing Yeltsin of sitting mute at Politburo meetings. The nomenklatura in the hall roared their approval, while most of the country made a hero of Yeltsin. Yeryomenko reveled in this liberating theater. Like millions of others, he was delighted to see the party begin at last to feed on itself, to expose its corruptions and splits live on television. But most of all, Arnold was thrilled that Memorial had won its great victory at the conference. By allowing the construction of a memorial to the victims of the regime, the party, largely in spite of itself, had begun a period of national repentance. "At least the conference wasn't a complete loss," he said from the airport. I told him I still wanted to come to Magadan. "I'll see you soon," I said. We both laughed. The possibility still seemed very far away. Memorial's victory at the party conference was sweet, but even its leaders knew that there was something too easy and superficial about it. "Stalin Died Yesterday" was the title of Mikhail Gefter's contribution to the There Is No Other Way collection, and by that he meant that Stalinism infected everything and everyone in the Soviet Union. Every factory and collective farm, every school and orphanage was built on Stalinist principles of gargantuan scale and iron authority. In every relationship, in trade, on buses, in almost any simple transaction, people treated each other with contempt and suspicion. That was Stalinism, too. Only now were people beginning to wonder out loud about the efficacy of such a life. Only now were they permitted to express those doubts in the papers, in books, on television. Stalinism is deep inside every one of us, Afanasyev told me after the party conference. Getting rid of that spirit is the most difficult thing of all. Next to that, getting the party to permit a monument is nothing. I met a filmmaker named Tofik Shakhverdiev, an Azerbaijani who had made a documentary called Stalin is with Us. He interviewed Stalinists all over the country, a Cossack on the Don River, a cab driver in Tbilisi, the man who was Bukharin's guard during the purge trial. At one point in the film, a group of veterans is sitting around a table singing songs in praise of Stalin. The old soldiers seemed transported. I told Tofik about my Kaganovich obsession, and instead of giving me a patronizing look, he laughed and said, "Me too, but he just won't answer the door." Lately, Moscow News and a few other papers had been trying to figure out, through interviews and polls, how people felt about Stalin. Just the idea of political opinion was new. But the polls were primitive, and I thought Tofik would have as good a sense as anyone what it meant now to be a Stalinist. Who were they? What did they want? The number of people who openly defend Stalin, really admire him, is limited, Tofik said. But if you talk about people whose first instinct is a passion for order, then I think you are talking about not less than half the people in the Soviet Union. You see, we use fashionable words like democracy and pluralism now. But so few people can really live without the security of complete order and control. In a perverse sense, the dissidents and the nonconformists of today are Stalinists. We Democrats have become like-minded in a way. We ignore or ridicule what's really out there. But off to the side, the Stalinists are going against the current. And this halo of being dissidents, strange as it seems, gives them a sort of dignity. They believed in their great cause and the creation of a great society, of communism. They see democracy and capitalism as a matter of the rich exploiting the poor, while in our system we are all poor. For them, the lack of an iron hand means prostitution, AIDS, emigration to the West. Stalinists derive their sense of themselves from their connection to the memory of the great man himself. When a slave kisses the hand of the master who whips him, he is getting some of the power of the master. A belief in his greatness appears. That spirit remained on view, at least physically, in the Republic of Georgia, among other places. Like all reporters in Moscow, I eventually made a trip to Gori, Stalin's hometown. As if that would tell me much. Gori was about an hour's drive through the mountains from the Georgian capital, Tbilisi. The centerpiece of the town was one of the most spectacular bits of kitsch on earth. The Gori party authorities, with some funding from Moscow, had moved Stalin's ancestral house, a tiny two-room structure, to the center of town in 1936. In an attempt to make a hut into Olympus, the party had built neoclassical columns to frame the great man's childhood home. The rooms themselves were intended to speak for Stalin's Leninist modesty. One room had a simple wooden table, the other a portrait of Stalin with his beady-eyed, black-shrouded mother. Next door, the vast Stalin Museum, as grandiose as the columns, was closed. Pending reconsideration, the guard told me. People who had finished looking around the Stalin house sat outside in the park under the trees eating sausages and apples. Not a single visitor I spoke to said he had any problem with Stalin. They said the country needed someone just like him to put an end to all the confusion. A factory worker I talked with showed me the tattoo on his chest. It was an impressive double portrait of Lenin and Stalin. I asked the worker about Gorbachev. Was there room for him? Gorbachev, he said. I wouldn't tattoo his name on my ass. Stalin was born Yosef Vissarionovich Djugashvili on December 21, 1879. His father was a drunk and beat his wife. He died young. When he was a boy, Stalin's favorite story was Alexander Kazbeg's The Patricide, the tale of an avenging hero of Georgia named Koba. After he read the book, Stalin demanded that all his friends call him Koba. That became his ideal, wrote a childhood friend. Stalin's closest comrades in the party called him Koba, sometimes until the day he had them shot. Stalin studied at a Russian Orthodox seminary. The monks said he was rude and disrespectful. His mother always wanted him to enter the clergy. When he visited her in 1936, by then he was already the Soviet leader and planning the Great Purge, she said, "What a pity you did not become a priest." In 1895, Stalin wrote, "Know this, he who fell like ashes to the ground, he who was never oppressed, will rise higher than the great mountains, on the wings of a bright hope." In 1926, Stalin's wife, Nadezhda, left him. He begged her to return, and at the same time had her followed by the secret police. 6 years later, they fought over Stalin's brutal treatment of the peasantry in Ukraine. When the row was over, Nadezhda left the room and shot herself. Her daughter, Svetlana, later said, "I believe that my mother's death, which he took as a personal betrayal, deprived his soul of the last vestiges of human warmth." Stalin lived for years by himself in the Kremlin. One of his guards said that Stalin bugged the phones of all his advisers and spent long periods of the day listening in on their conversations. Alexei Rybin, a secret police officer and Stalin's guard, wrote in Sociological Research magazine that Stalin loved to tell his limousine driver to pull over to the side of the road to give old women rides home. "He was just that kind of man," said Rybin. In the Homeric tradition, Pravda used countless titles to refer to Stalin. Leader and teacher of the workers of the world, father of the peoples, wise and intelligent chief of the Soviet people, the greatest genius of all times and peoples, the greatest military leader of all times and peoples, Corypheus of the sciences, faithful comrade-in-arms of Lenin, devoted continuer of Lenin's cause, the Mountain Eagle, and best friend of all children. There were many Western intellectuals who were all too willing to indulge Stalin in his cruelties. In the midst of a state-imposed famine, George Bernard Shaw looked up from his plate at the Metropole Hotel and said gaily, "Do you see any food shortages here?" Later he added that he took his hat off to Stalin for having delivered the goods. In a meeting with Stalin, Shaw's traveling companion, Lady Astor, asked, "How long will you go on killing people?" "As long as necessary," Stalin replied. Lady Astor quickly changed the subject, asking Stalin if he could help her find a good Russian nanny for her children. After his own audience with Stalin, H.G. Wells reported he had never met a man more candid, fair, and honest. The American ambassador in Moscow, Joseph Davies, wrote of Stalin that a child would like to sit on his lap and a dog would sidle up to him. Stalin, who was 5'4", wanted a court portrait done showing him as a tall man with powerful hands. The painter, Nalbandian, complied with portraying Stalin from a flattering angle with his hands folded powerfully across his belly. Stalin had his other portrait painters shot and their paintings burned. Stalin rewrote the official short biography of Stalin, personally adding the passage, Stalin never allowed his work to be marred by the slightest hint of vanity, conceit, or self-adulation. Stalin died of a stroke on March 5, 1953. He once said that those revolutionaries who refused to use terror as a political tool were vegetarians. According to Roy Medvedev, Stalin's victims numbered 40 million. Solzhenitsyn says the number is far greater, perhaps 60 million. The debate continues even now. It was the trial of the season. Since the rise of Gorbachev, a retired lawyer from Kharkov named Ivan Shekhovtsov had filed repeated lawsuits against various intellectuals and newspapers for slandering Stalin. He made a career of these suits, 16 so far. This time his opposition was Vecherna'ya Moskva, the city's evening newspaper. Stalin is the father of our people. Slander is the dirty weapon of the anti-Stalinists. Get those signs out of here, said the judge. At the witness table, Shekhovtsov sat taking notes. He wore a suit and a row of military medallions. He had been a tank gunner on the Baltic and Ukrainian fronts in the war, and had lost part of a lung in a firefight. There were a half-dozen benches, all crammed with Shekhovtsov's supporters. Most of them were older men and women, and nearly all wore ribbons and medals from the war. They were angry that they had to get rid of their banners, but they made up for it with loud gossiping. There were some nasty remarks about the Jews and Armenians, about Raisa Gorbachev, about Memorial. They carried copies of right-wing journals, Nash Sovremennik, our contemporary, which was hardline Russian nationalist, and Molodaya Gvardia, Young Guard, which was hardline Stalinist. There was a lot of whispered speculation about whether the representative from Vecherna'ya Moskva was a Jew. Of course, they concluded, she must be. We spent our lives building socialism, and now these people, Afanasyev, Adamovich, Korotich, they are getting rid of socialism and they are succeeding, a woman named Valentina Nikitina told me as we waited through the lull in the proceedings. She, too, was a decorated veteran of the war. She said she had lost many friends and relatives in the war. Half the people I knew, she said. And the idea of reforming, much less dismantling the system, was unconscionable. These people are like the Hungarians in 1956. They are staging a counter-revolution. The majority